We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse. The fifth column.
Comrades, compañeros, citizens of the fifthdom, you know this voice, and it's not the voice of Camille Foster, because that voice is silent, because he has decided that he has another conference to go to. And frequent listeners of this podcast know that Camille prizes conferences with half-wit billionaires above brilliant conversations with poor people like us. So no, Camille, and if that's what you're looking for, I know that's not what you're looking for, you turn it off right now, but you're not going to do that. You know why? You know why, Matt?
Because we're poor people in a penthouse with an incredible view over Manhattan?
Yes, but they don't need to know that. I would like them to think we're doing this in tunnels under Khan Yunis, but we're not. What I was getting at, you dummy, is that the other day I ran into an old comrade, one of the more brilliant people that I know and I've worked with. And I said, you got to come back on the podcast. And right after that, and this listener will know who he is, because I got an email, which I, as I said earlier, it must have been a Jake Siegel puppet account.
Yeah.
Because it said, hey, when are you going to have Jake back on the show?
You got to do the voice.
And well, I can't do that because he's right here.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I can do Finkelstein, but not him.
When are you going to get Siegel back on the podcast?
By the way, I want him to do Finkelstein.
Did I tell you that I sent you that thing.
There's a Reddit group, yeah.
There's a Reddit thing for this lefty podcaster named Destiny. Do you know this person?
I do, yeah.
So that's Jake Siegel, by the way. We'll introduce him really. I mean, there's no point in podcast introducing people because they see it in the description and the name of the file. They know he's here. But
I like the ceremony, though.
Yeah, the ceremony, yeah. Then we get to say great things about you. You know, he lives in Israel. He writes for Tablet. He comes from the illustrious Siegel family, who we've mentioned a bazillion times in the show. Harry, his brother's been on the show. And our mutual friend, Eli Lake, who we saw the other day when I saw Jake, said, hey, your brother, Harry, he's got a bit woke. And I said, what? I think he's always been like that. He was trying to say he's a bit of lefty.
Yeah, not yes, woke. Harry is a bit, yeah. Lefty. He's a bit. Just like New York lefty. That's fine. But like cop lefty. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah, the cops gave him a hard time recently.
Daily News lefty.
Daily News lefty.
Yeah, exactly. Daily News lefty. Yeah.
He actually likes public sector unions, and he's wrong about that, yeah, but he still does battle with them, so it's fine.
It's fine. Yeah, it's fine. He's a character. He's our Jimmy Breslin, as we talked about.
It's high praise.
And also, that's just the first family of New York journalism, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely right. So we have Jake here. It just happened to be in town, and I hooked him into coming here. And of course, I couldn't hook Camille into coming to his own damn podcast, but Jake Siegel happily comes to, you know, Soho in New York City. And shows up. So we have a lot of things to talk about, right? I do want to say one thing first. And this is what I had to refer to when I was grabbing my computer. I'm going to go on a slight rant about elitists. You know, as is different from normal.
Are you wearing your Stan Smiths, by the way?
Class rage doesn't mean I don't try to get in there and trick them. And then stab them. I'm like a Gurkha. God, I'm like a Gurkha of class rage. I go in and I slit their throats at night.
Yeah.
I turned on, this is an incredible thing. I turned on MSNBC this morning. And I saw Jen Psaki talking to Mika Brzezinski. These are the people that are carrying the flag, the Rotafana. The Bruins scored? Okay. My daughter is allowed to come in and tell me the Bruins scored 1-0 Bruins. she's De Fana Hoch. She's carrying the red flag for the working class. And I realized that Mika Brzezinski, her father was national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski under Jimmy Carter. And Jen Psaki is from Greenwich. And she went to Greenwich Country Day, which I believe is $60,000, $70,000 a year.
Again, did you just have this list with you at all
that
times?
That I knew. I had to look up Mika, and she went to Madeira School, where Brooke Astor went to school, which is currently $60,000 for K through two or something. And they were telling me what is good for Americans and the working class people. Right after that, I saw another clip. And this one wasn't live. I saw a clip, and it was a guy who was talking about a poll that he had conducted. And I just didn't like the looks of the guy. The Chiron came up, and I said, oh, I bet that's Michael Beschloss's son. And guess what?
Oh, no.
It was Michael Beschloss's son. And I am watching
this fucking, the lefty network in America is just a series of rich private school kids who have rich parents in telling us what the working class wants. And it's very, very funny. And they're like, I don't understand this Donald Trump guy. And I'm like, you know, I know you went to Greenwich Country Day. Of course you don't understand this. So I thought that was an amazing moment. I never watched this channel. And I turned it on and I met with, you know, just it was like the social register.
Nepo in like baby 1930. After Nepo baby.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like the out parties.
At least Ben Dreyfuss is a total failure of a Nepo baby.
He is. Yeah. He doesn't even have two eyes. He can't even get two eyes. That's how bad he is at being a Nepo baby. Yeah.
But I
think that there's like another Dreyfuss. Like he's like one of the bad Baldwins or something. Like yeah. Richard Dreyfuss's brother, Steve Dreyfuss.
Defective Dreyfuss. No.
But anyway, we have Jake here. And the great thing about Jake is we've been meaning to discuss two pieces that I think a number of people have written. And the first one is the, what was it, Jake? 170,000 word.
Yeah, roughly. A Guide to Understanding the Hoax of the Century, 13 Ways of Looking at Disinformation.
13? Come on, man.
I mean, it was...
You get the reference.
Eh.
13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. So, Wallace Stevens Poe. That was my...
I'm from the West Coast. We don't do poetry.
Pretentious literary...
Our poetry is...
You didn't get
Charles Bukowski or none.
Yeah.
Oh, What a Man I Was. That's our poetry.
It wasn't a Robert Frost reference, so you didn't get it, right?
Yeah.
But that piece, when it came out, I think I inquired and I was like, wait, Jake went to Israel, right? And somebody told me that you, I think it was maybe your sometimes boss at Tablet. Are you full-time at Tablet?
No, I left to work on a book, which is an expansion of the disinformation piece.
That's already a book.
And should be coming. No, there's so much more to say.
Oh, is there?
There's so much more to say. I
mean, thank God we don't edit these podcasts.
The history, for one thing.
Oh, my God.
And the secret history.
There's
a secret history, and then there's a unmined history, an unexplored history going back to, I trace it back to the Wilson administration and the First World War.
Holy shit.
And birth of the... secrecy and security state.
Do you mention Edward Bernays anywhere in this piece?
Ah.
Of course you do. Yes.
So I don't
listeners,
mention Bernays.
The smile was beautiful.
I don't mention Bernays, but you know how I was introduced to Bernays.
I don't.
Through Moynihan.
Is that true?
Yes.
How did I, how, when was that?
No. Through Daniel Patrick Moynihan. But
you have to understand there's so many brilliant Moynihans, you have to narrow it down.
But as I told you the other day, it is ultimately through you because you were the one who had turned me on. I had been through my father, the full Moynihan collection was in Brooklyn, but you had reminded me of Secrecy, which I then read very attentively and then read 50 other things after I read Secrecy.
Is it one of those books, because I think it is, where if you're somebody like me who likes looking at footnotes because I don't trust anything, and then you spider off to like a 10, 20 other books from Moynihan's collection of books that he's using for Secrecy?
Precisely. And also in the case of the Moynihan book, there's a great foreword by a popular writer, a little-known guy who wrote a number of kind of popular histories of the FBI, and I think of the Brown Scare, named Richard Gid Powers.
Yes, who wrote an amazing book called Not Without Honor, which, by the way, is it tells you so much about the era and the triumph of the kind of Victor Navasky narrative of McCarthyism. Mm. And, you know, that everybody who was accused was, you know, just a good old liberal. And Richard Gid Powers wrote a book called Not Without Honor, which was a history of anti-communism.
That's right.
Saying that you had to actually say that, no, it wasn't without honor. And it's like, actually... You know, the dishonorable ones is a pretty short list. The honorable ones is a pretty long list. But that's hilarious that Richard Gid Powers wrote the part of that book. Yeah.
So I get into Bernays, who is, for people unfamiliar, was Freud's nephew and got his start in the U.S. as a working in advertising and then developed the sort of modern public relations campaign.
That's right. Yeah.
And then wrote a book called Propaganda and was a seminal propagandist from an era when that had not yet become
a pejorative word,
nor one associated with tyranny.
No, I mean, in fact, the ministry that was taken over and given to Joseph Goebbels was called the Ministry of Propaganda and Enlightenment. It was actually called the Ministry of Propaganda because it was not an,
so a was the British department that Orwell worked for, right? Like it was
Wells. Did Orwell work?
I think so.
Second World War.
He worked in
The Second World War.
He did, BBC, yeah. I think, had a Department of Propaganda. It could be a no step on snake situation, so I don't want to get out in front of my skis.
If you don't know what Matt's not talking about, go listen to the last episode in which
it's become a meme. I'm happy with it.
He careened off a cliff and just owned it. It was incredible. And if you don't, I'm not going to explain it, but go back and listen. It was very fun.
Nope.
But so this is, so what is the general premise of the piece? I mean, you can tell kind of from the title of it, but like, what was the necessity of writing? Because, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, even, you know, people on the left, like the Glenn Greenwalds of the world, people on the right in the sort of more MAGA universe, they're writing similar stuff, that this is a total hoax, particularly the Russia stuff. What was it that you brought to it? You said, I need to write my own thing about this.
Well, I think I had the conceptual framework that had been lacking from other excellent reporting that was narrower and that failed to see that this was part of an integral system. So, you know, I am saying, as other people had said, that the threat of disinformation had been cynically instrumentalized by the U.S. intelligence agencies and by the Democratic Party in order to, first of all, initiate and then operate the Russiagate hoax. So the idea of disinformation had been instrumental to that because it had created this all-encompassing atmosphere of panic related to Russian infiltration of not just the American political system, but specifically of American social media companies,
which
were supposed to be the gateway through which the Russians could then puppeteer the American political system.
Yeah.
So people had done very significant reporting on this,
but
it was narrower.
And is it fair to say that the Russians and, you know, whether it was the GRU or the FSB, did some version of this, which is true that they did, but it just was wildly unsuccessful and pretty small potatoes, right?
Yeah, and also, yes, that's absolutely true. And also nothing that the United States had not experienced before. I think the claims that it was qualitatively entirely different from past attempts to sort of carry out information operations were dramatically overstated for reasons that had to do both with cynical opportunism and the idea that this could be used to effectively categorize domestic populism as a foreign threat, which would then make it subject to the rule of the security and intelligence agencies, and also due to a genuine panic among the, let's call them the ruling establishment figures, who at a very deep level viewed domestic populism as a kind of
threat,
existential threat, not simply a rival political force, but a barbarism at the gates that would undo the progress of the 20th century and that would sabotage all of liberal democracy. And because it was both useful to them, served their class interests, and played on very deep fears and feelings about what domestic populism represented, it created this extraordinarily powerful force in which, you know, these various motivations converged across the federal government and across the kind of parallel federal government, which is the nonprofits and the, you know, academic media complex, as it were. And just to round out the last point, you know, the difference between the approach I take in this piece for Tablet and the approach I take in the book and some of the other reporting is that what I am describing is a new form of government. So I don't see this ultimately as just being about censorship, for instance, though I think censorship is extraordinarily pernicious and is maybe the clearest manifestation of this. And a symptom that we can all identify. But ultimately, it's not about censorship. Censorship is a tool, and censorship has appeared at various times in American history.
Sure, yeah.
The scale of censorship, the type of censorship, the fact that the censorship was conducted secretly through the infrastructural layer of public discourse. So in other words, it wasn't a censor declaring the authority to shut people down. It was a secret mechanism for shutting down whole categories of thought and speech that was inserted into the new, into the infrastructural layer of the new public square through the essentially co-optation of the social media companies and other internet companies like Google, who sort of, because they're much cannier about all of this, doesn't get mentioned in the same breath as Twitter from the Twitter files or Facebook. But Google's every bit as important, if not more important, in terms of their censorship and their pre-bunking efforts and all of this. And what it amounts to altogether, I believe, is a new form of government.
It's funny, and I want to ask Matt to do something unenviable, because I'm not sure if he agrees with it, but I'm going to ask you to steelman this in a few ways, because, as you know, we've all heard the counterarguments to this. But a couple points. One is that for people who believe that the Russian infiltration is something new, it's not only that it's something old, and we've seen all this stuff before, but I have pointed out a number of times, you can go back, I'm not going to go through it again, but you can go back and listen to episodes where I do talk about this, is that one of the most successful Russian operations of all time in this, prior to there being social media and things like this, was, I believe, there's very convincing evidence, that the conspiracy theories, which still to this day is probably the most popular conspiracy theory amongst Americans, that there was a conspiracy to kill John F. Kennedy, was started by the KGB. It's a very, because they were afraid, because Oswald had defected the Soviet Union, they were going to be blamed. They were not responsible for it. That is totally true. But they planted the seeds, and the first book that was published about a Kennedy conspiracy was published in New York City by a KGB front publishing house. And that was a very successful thing. They've been doing this for a long time. This is nothing new. And at some point, I just don't want to forget this, to come back to, you know, the uniqueness of this time where we get COVID, which allows us a totally different level of, like, okay, we want the government hand here. We don't, because the thing is that every time Matt, Camille, myself, guests, whoever, would say, well, I don't know about this, you would have people on Twitter, people in comments saying, you know how many people you've confined to death? To death. You're actually committing homicide by saying, maybe this thing isn't right. And it turns out that a lot of the things that we did question weren't right, and everyone acknowledges that now. But as far as, like, kind of the counterpoints of this, Matt, you know them well. Is there anything that Jake said that you disagree with? But what is the pushback on this kind of argument? And Jake, you can volunteer these things too. You've written a lot about it. I'm sure a lot of people have pushback on it.
I think the first question is, well, you said secret mechanism and infrastructure. And my, like, RFK DAR just, like, went off.
My brain worms started
glowing in the night. What is the secret mechanism, and what is the infrastructure, and how can you convince me that there is a new, like, secret branch of the bad thing?
Okay, so there are sort of two levels to this. One level is the formal federal agencies that were either remissioned, so, you know, had previous missions like the Global Engagement Center at the State Department, or other agencies that were created specifically to deal with this disinformation threat.
When? Ish.
Let's say between 2016 and 2020.
So, like, Trump is the president.
Yes, Trump is the president.
Trump is the president.
That doesn't mean that he's authorizing.
No, that makes
to take place.
That actually makes it interesting, right?
Like, yeah.
That's a deep state kind of cut.
I think that's exactly what that is. I think.
Really? So, like, yeah, people within the State Department are really, all right. So,
absolutely.
Like, they are saying, okay, deep breath. What can we do here? What we'll do is we'll, like, have this disinformation center or whatever it was called at the time, and this is going to help us.
Well, they're saying exactly this. So it's not, one needn't be conspiratorial to recognize that, you know, very large segments, if not a clear majority of full-time federal bureaucrats, were hostile to Donald Trump, and the most prominent among them took steps to mitigate what they saw as the risk from Trump. I mean, this is an exceptional situation we have, right? And we have now generals being valorized in the Atlantic Monthly because they supposedly, you know, essentially defied the sitting president of the United States.
Slowed down the withdrawal from Afghanistan, for example.
One thing among many, and in the self-mythology, you know, prevented escalation with China, and there are multiple elements to this. But the point is, whatever you think about Donald Trump as a president, it's not... like it's all on the surface that there was very serious and widespread opposition to him from within the federal government. At the same time, what we're not talking about now, ultimately, we're not talking about normal domestic political opposition or partisanship. We're talking about something quite different, which is the claim that Donald Trump was an agent of the Russian government. And that is the claim which, as we now know, originates with a opposition research firm, that they are Fusion GPS. They're the mechanism to implant it, but it's actually like a genuine conspiracy in the literal definition of the word that not only generates this false claim against the Republican nominee Donald Trump, but then through the mechanisms of the legal system, inserts this false claim into the legal system, and then inserts the false claim into the intelligence agencies so that it becomes a kind of a doctrine of the U.S. intelligence agencies, and that occurs through John Brennan, right, the
serial liar,
serial hire, head of the CIA, yeah, who insists
and NSA too, right?
Yes,
no,
Brett Brennan. That's Hayden.
Michael
Hayden.
They both
suck.
Brennan is an even more sort of conspicuous partisan hack. Now an MSNBC host.
Contributor,
contributor, not host. But the point about Brennan is he produces what is supposed to be this, you know, this consensus, the ICA, the intelligence community assessment in 2017, which is supposed to represent a consensus among the various intelligence agencies about Russian interference in the 2016 election. And we now know not only did he essentially cobble this together himself, it didn't really represent a consensus. And we know this through subsequent congressional hearings and reporting on them. What he did was he cherry-picked the information that supported this assessment. He left out conflicting information when the whole point of an ICA is it is supposed to be the least controversial position held by the intelligence agencies. It is the bedrock consensus position. But in fact, what he did was take a very conspicuously partisan and, in fact, contrived read of what had happened in 2016. He wrote it into the U.S. intelligence agency sort of official. And by the way, he also included the Steele dossier material in the annex.
And all the David Ignatius's of the world, like, oh my God, this must be true. Quickly, before I know Michael wants to jump in. So do you think, and you can't know, do you think that John Brennan in particular, or anyone else who was in there, knew that it was bullshit?
I can't know. I think that at that level, I don't think it matters.
I think it does matter in the sense of, Like I said on the podcast, and I remember writing some kind of Twitter thread in May of 2017, like everyone is acting according to their own internal logic, thinking that they are being moral at this moment. I don't know if it's true or not, but like some of those things turned out to be decently true in terms of predictions. But like, is there a plausible internal logic by which what he does is defensible?
No. And the reason
that's important,
but the reason why is not because there's not a plausible psychological case that he believes that there's some deeper truth. The reason why, look, the point is that the procedurally, he had gone so far afield of what an ICA is supposed to be, right? He had taken what is supposed to represent this consensus among the more than a dozen intelligence agencies, and he had turned it into a very pointy partisan instrument. And he had done this through mechanisms that were clearly violations of the spirit, if not the letter, of that process. I think when you're the head of the CIA, you can, to some extent, you know, you can simply do what you want with these things. I can't say that he knew he was lying, because maybe he believed Donald Trump really is a Russian agent and he's doing all, you know, he's violating all of these procedural regulations in pursuit of some greater patriotic good. I doubt it. I seriously doubt it. And his later actions suggest a much more venal character than that. I don't get the sense that John Brennan has America's national interest at the top of his list of concerns. But I don't want to speculate, because I don't know. But look, I'm long-winded, so I never answered your initial question. Let me circle back quickly. Your question was, like, what's the evidence of the sort of the secret mechanisms of censorship? And all of this stuff about Brennan and the ICA and the Russiagate conspiracy being seeded into both the government, so it becomes official, it's part of the official record of the intelligence agencies, and into the media, obviously. What this does is this sets up the atmosphere in which we're now operating in a state of exception. Russia has penetrated the American political system, and we now need to take extraordinary measures to stop this. As one of his last acts in office, when he signs the NDAA, Obama authorizes, right, he signs into law this Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation Act, which takes this State Department agency, the Global Engagement Center, which had originally been created to counter Islamic State and jihadist messaging, and he repurposes it under the Navy SEAL who's running it at the time, Michael Lumpkin, to act as the new counter-disinformation agency. Well, Lumpkin, at the time, in an interview, or on a panel he's on, actually, that gets reported by Defense One, you know, Lumpkin is giving statements about how, in order to pursue this new threat operating in cyberspace, we need to stop abiding by these outdated distinctions between foreign and domestic actors, because the internet is borderless. And if the U.S. is going to be effective in its counterterrorism and counter disinformation efforts, it needs to operate in the way that is native to the internet, which is without regard for these sort of arbitrary 20th century firewalls around privacy. You know, there's also
the FISA stuff was very similar.
FISA stuff and also, you know, the 1972 Privacy Act. So that's the background. Then what you get is the installation of intelligence agency bodies inside the social media companies. So there's the Foreign Influence Task Force, right, which is nominally run
by name. Super bad name.
Not a great
name. A bad name, yeah.
Especially since it very quickly – so this is a task force headed by the FBI, but that conducts these essentially all agency calls. So it's bringing in intelligence from different agencies that's now operating essentially within the sort of interior layer of Twitter, right? And you have these Slack channels open up. You have this open communication back and forth between – this is what's in the Murthy case, right, that went before the Supreme Court, is this question of the government coercing and pressuring social media companies to censor certain information. How much exactly they censored is under dispute. But it was referred to in the initial by the federal judge who initially looked at it before it went to the Supreme Court as the largest act of censorship in American history. All of this foreign pretext that like sets all of this up so you can have this extraordinary penetration by the government into these social media companies, which are the public square effectively at this point, which begins under the auspices of the foreign threat, as you alluded to earlier, is then gradually, as it was always intended to be, in my opinion, gradually turned into a domestic censorship apparatus to the point where when COVID arrives, you have these shills in the media and the NGOs who've now sort of adopted a new role as the outward-facing enforcers of this new regulatory
rooting
regime.
On censorship.
Rooting on censorship and declaring anyone who opposes it, you know, a threat to public health who's, like, killing millions of people.
It's a funny thing, because if I grant everything that you said, right, and I don't, some of the stuff I don't know, it's new to me and I'm excited to read the book, but if you grant all of this, what you can understand is that big government apparatuses like this tend to get too confident. And where it all goes wrong is a couple of ways. The Hunter Biden laptop thing is where you see it go. 50 heads, former heads, department heads of various intelligence agencies say that this is fake. It's very clearly not fake because you can adjudicate this stuff very quickly. Take an email from this laptop, because a lot of people have it, and call the person and say, did you get this email? And then you know that these emails are real, right?
Just quickly, a laptop which had been in the possession
of the FBI for a long time.
For 9 months when that statement came out.
So very easy to prove. So clearly they're lying about it from the beginning. And to your point, that, you know, putting the pressure on Twitter that America's newspaper, the newspaper of Alexander Hamilton, the New York Post, is not allowed to you know, they've been shut out. Of their Twitter account, the links and all. I think it was on Facebook too. Weren't the links shut down on Facebook too? So it wasn't just Twitter, right?
DMs were censored. This is how far the censorship went.
Yeah.
If I direct messaged you on Twitter and included a link to the New York Post's reporting, right, the paper of Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah. A week before the election.
The website, started by the guy from Dude, Where's My Car, would censor a private message containing reporting from Alexander Hamilton's newspaper.
I think it's that where you see it go too far, and people start pricking up their ears to this. Because, you know, the Russia stuff, I think people see enough, and, you know, just a little bit, and they're not paying too much of attention. They say, well, you know, we don't want the Russians meddling, et cetera. So people are kind of walking along with this and not really challenging it too much. And then the lab leak stuff happens. And it goes so far that you even have Jon Stewart on the Stephen Colbert show doing a little bit. And I love Colbert and how sort of co-opted he had been and just become this, you know, establishment figure, no longer a comedian, just, you know, being.
He literally did a song and dance routine about the vaccine
which is with people dressed up as needles. But Jon Stewart is doing a very obvious thing. He says, you know, this is the fucking Wuhan virology lab that they're studying this stuff. Where do you think it came from? And he sits down, and the most hilarious thing is you have Stephen Colbert say, oh my God, I guess, we're sitting here with Senator Ron Johnson. Remember that he said that?
I don't.
That was his joke. He's like, if you believe this, you must be Senator Ron Johnson. This is amazing. What crazy Republicans believe. Mm. And I think at that point, people were like, well, wait, that seemed, Stewart's making sense. That seems logical. We've been shutting people down, banning them off of YouTube and Facebook in particular. I think that was more so than
banning not just anyone, like banning Rand Paul, who last I looked was a senator.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about the Tom Cotton editorial of the New York Times. This guy's a sitting senator. Yeah, no, Rand Paul also a sitting senator.
For suggesting that masks don't really do all that much, which became a position that the CDC took like 6 months later, but he's banned, kicked off of YouTube.
That, I think, is that, you know, it was the perfect time for these people when COVID happened, because you could say you're killing people and we're trying to save people's lives. But of course, they were so excited after the glorious successes they've had since the whole Russiagate nonsense that they step way too far on this one. And the average person is actually engaged in the issue of COVID because it affects everybody, right? Mm-hmm. The Russia stuff, you can back off a little bit. You're like, I guess that's real. And then all of a sudden, wait a second. You said that the mask didn't work. And then you said that you just did that because you were trying to make sure that the PPE stuff was there for nurses. And now you're saying it does work and everyone has to have it. The cloth ones do work. And then you tell me later the cloth ones don't work. And then it's always been, you know, a feral bat in a cave in some weird province in China, not from the actual lab, but makes perfect. You can't do that either. That's when the average person, people that I knew, were like, man, they're really just bearing down on us and just the most basic kind of quote unquote dissent of this stuff. And I think that's, to me, like, it doesn't surprise me And the reason, like, I'm somebody that doesn't like conspiracy theories. I don't think this is a conspiracy theory. I think this is something that I'm sure that there's be stuff, but when I read your book, I'll disagree with, or we can fight about. But when you have a government that is after something, we can find a million examples of this. There's so much madness in Len Kolodny's book, Silent Coup, but there's so much interesting stuff in it too. I think Kolodny goes a little too far. He was sued by John Dean. The idea that there was a, like an apparatus within the government that was trying to get rid of Richard Nixon is not wrong. Particularly when you read that book and you say, and also the Silent Man, the John Dean book that James Rosen wrote, which is another really good book that is in the Kolodny kind of universe, that there was a sort of dark conspiracy. Well, that wasn't a dark conspiracy. There were people in the government that hated Nixon and they saw an opportunity. Nothing strange about that. Trump writ large, this is the Nixon. I remember at the beginning of this podcast when Donald Trump takes office and I said, you can go back and find this. I'm sure one of our completely psychotic listeners will go back and find this. But I said, you know, it's very bad idea for Donald Trump to go to CIA headquarters. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And he was like, you guys are fucking losers. And he's like, all these guys, you're liars.
Gestapo.
Like Gestapo. And I'm like, oh my God, they're going to turn on this guy so hard.
Set your watch.
And I said, this is a bad idea, Donald, because they're going to turn, they have the power to turn on you. And then, you know, a couple years later, you're like, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Do you remember what Schumer said at the time?
No, I don't.
Oh,
I
mean, yeah.
Schumer effectively said you shouldn't go after the intelligence agency.
Oh, that's right. He did.
They can destroy you.
Yes. Yeah. So if it's a conspiracy, it's one that Chuck Schumer understands can be real, can be very easily real, right?
Yeah, of course. And it's also a conspiracy that many people bragged about at every step along the way because they claimed that they were saving democracy. And I, at this point, I've stopped caring about whether or not it is conspiratorial. I see it again as far broader and more profound in its implications than that. I think it is a epochal change in a form of government and political sovereignty. And what I mean by that is that instead of the sort of standard 20th century model of presenting information to voters about the positive impacts of the policies that you have implemented or intend to implement, and then trying to cull together electoral majorities that way, which is, you know, the sort of standard model, and along with the doling out patronage and various other kind of conventional forms of appeal in a democracy to get the support of voters.
It's political graft, you know, general.
A combination of political graft and also bringing together electoral coalitions by appealing to their interests. Why is it that, let's focus on the Democrats for the moment because they're the ruling party in the United States. Why do the Democrats seem so profoundly, not simply uninterested, but in many ways contemptuous of the very idea of appealing to the interests of the majority of voters? I mean, do the majority of prospective voters for the Democrats, is their like top issue is gender affirming care for children? And like, is this?
I know I said this the other day when I was at this dissident dialogues thing, and I said, "What, you know, we're not dissidents. There's one real dissident there was an Iranian dissident, but." Important to point out that everybody here who says Leah Thomas is kind of weird that she, he, whatever, I don't know, whatever, I don't even understand, I guess it's, swims with girls. My views on that are in line with the mainstream on this. My views on affirmative action are in the line with the mainstream on this stuff. The people who believe that they're not in line with the mainstream are people that are reading the New York Times,
right?
You know, watching MSNBC.
Your views on Israel.
Also very much in the mainstream. But if you, Jake, if you watch any of these things, right? And if you read any of the editorials in the New York Times or opinion pieces, you're going to run up against very quickly somebody who says that, yeah, every time there is an election, we say this is the most important election of our lifetime. But this one, democracy is on the line. If you vote for the wrong guy, you're voting for the end of American democracy, which has been with us for since the 1776. What do you say to people who say that, well, look at January 6th, look at the things that Donald Trump has said, what he plans on doing. Is there an existential threat when it comes to American democracy and this election and MAGA in general, I guess.
So my real point is I don't think these people actually care about democracy, because what they have settled on, the reason why they pursue these deeply unpopular policies that are not simply like edge policies, but that seem to evince a genuine hostility towards their own potential voters. The reason why they pursue this is because they no longer believe that they need to work through democratic means to appeal to voters to get votes.
There's times
they believe
they can leverage power.
They believe that the internet is the crucial high ground. And this is an idea that is very, very formally elaborated, first in military doctrine and in information warfare doctrine. They see control of the internet as the crucial high ground through which small groups of people can control vast human populations. Now, the evidence for this claim is all there in their claims about Russian interference in 2016. Everything they say that Russia is doing in 2016 tells you how they understand the power of the internet. So I don't need to tell you that the sort of security apparatus and ruling establishment in the United States believes that control over the internet is sufficient to effectively brainwash American voters and tell them who to elect. They said that continuously in 2016. My argument is that's not true at all, actually.
Yeah, actually, it isn't.
American voters aren't that stupid.
Correct.
They aren't that gullible.
Yes.
Yes, the internet is a powerful tool, but there's not some hyper-efficient mechanism of causality where, you know, if you put the right meme into circulation on Twitter, people vote for the candidate you want them to vote for. So I'm the one who has argued against that all along. So
as we did, all of us individually.
Right, but it's relevant to
MSNBC, Michael's, for
example. But it's relevant to Michael's question, right? Yeah. Because these people who claim that Donald Trump is an existential threat to democracy, it seems to me have effectively given up on democracy.
There was a time, and you could probably, you know, string together clips from this show over the past 5 years, 6 years, and put together something, a version of this argument in a way. Because I remember us, you and I, Matt, having a conversation about the people who say that democracy is dying, so we have to take on undemocratic means ourselves.
Yeah, that's the...
There's a million examples
super
of
this. Standard, actually.
Standard, I mean, when Roe was overturned, serious people, quote unquote, in serious newspapers talking about, well, we have to change the composition of the Supreme Court, meaning we have to stack the Supreme Court as FDR suggested in, I guess, 36 or 37, that it's time for us to do that. And there's versions of this that we see here and there. What I wonder...
I mean, the prosecution of Trump in Lower Manhattan, that was, as we speak, is a interpretation of federal election law that has never been tried.
Yes, because something that is legal, which is to pay hush money to a porn star, is legal. But when you filter it through that, well, this was an in-kind campaign donation.
Interfering with an election. What is more interfering with an election? Like, I mean, actually having the sitting, like Republican nominee have to have his ass in a courtroom in Lower Manhattan during a presidential year?
Or trying to throw him off the ballot in Colorado or various other places.
Or him paying a hush money in 2016.
So Jake, do you think that, you know, there are people that believed, I mean, I don't know how anyone can believe the Russia stuff. I mean, I actually did believe it for a second because it made
sense. So did I.
Yeah, it made sense.
So did I.
Right? You know, I've seen Russia do this in the past.
I believe that he would have absolutely like fucking cashed that check if it came.
If it came, but it never came. Right. So I'm thinking, and then I guess when I first realized it wasn't real is when I saw my first interview with Carter Page and I was like, this is the fucking mastermind. This like dolt who's like wandering around saying, what? Like he knew nothing. It was incredible. But do you think that people like you and I, and I think probably maybe everybody at this table or in this room, believe that in a certain sense at the beginning, did believe it and then said, let's leverage this? Or did it just become, this is the thing I always point out, that there's the conversation among scholars about whether, and I mention this all the time, I'm sorry to mention it again, of whether or not there was a decision to drop the atomic bomb. Because Harry Truman didn't know about this and FDR dies. And it's just the forward motion of it. It just happens. Is it like people twisting their mustaches and saying, ha ha, we got them now? Or is it a point where like, we have this power, let's use it?
I think it might be both. I think that I don't rule out the possibility that there are a very small group of people who are more deliberate, more aware of what's available within the sort of, you know, the political system as it currently exists, where the seams are that can be exploited, et cetera. I don't know that for a fact, and I tend to not make that argument because I don't think it's necessary, but I find it unwise to rule it out. However, I think that most of this, perhaps even all of it, can be explained by the kind of momentum you're describing. What that momentum refers to, though, is not simply people acting from mistaken premises or out of good intentions. What it really refers to is people licensing themselves to take ever greater leaps outside the bounds of the law, outside the bounds of democratic procedure, because they believe that they are fundamentally right, because they believe that their opponents are fundamentally, you know, vicious and evil or dangerous or whatever it is. And that, you know, my understanding of human psychology is that once you have begun down this path, it becomes incredibly difficult to get off of it because it's such a blow to your own ego. It means that you were taken for a ride. It means that effectively, you know, you've been on the bad side all along, and it just gets harder and harder to course correct.
Is there anyone in the Russiagate story, and if I had enough time to think about it, I could probably come up with somebody, who has doubled back and said, I was invested in this and I was wrong?
That's a good question. Nobody comes to mind immediately.
No, actually.
But look, some people in the media, I think there's been a couple of people who said, I believed in this, but they weren't prime movers.
Right. I can't think of anyone. The closest
I would say, and the craziest thing is he wrote a book about it. I think Michael Isikoff has come back on all that stuff. So, yeah. And I think he's a very a good reporter, an honest broker. And I think that, you know, he wrote that book with David Corn, and I think he's kind of
trying to
abandon
new phone who dis.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll give you a specific example, though. Like, you know, you were saying you believe this stuff initially, Trump, Russia.
Yeah, totally.
I would say there were a good 6 to 8 months or something where I always assumed it was exaggerated. It seemed to me that it was blown out of proportion. My most fundamental assumption, one perhaps I wasn't even fully conscious of, was that elected representatives in the United States Congress could not carry out a kind of scheme of this magnitude.
Yes.
And the thing that finally disabused me of this was watching Adam Schiff. And I just realized one day, he's just lying. These are the fourth or fifth time he talked about the smoking gun and all the evidence that was about to drop. And I mean, like, Schiff's a deeply, deeply unimpressive character.
Yeah, right? That's true.
This is not
some
canny political operator. He's like a good sort of brute force apparatchik. And, you know, once you realize that, now, did Schiff believe it? I look at it as the psychology of the apparatchik is, well, they don't look too deeply, you know, like they're...
Well, it's more important that you want to believe it.
And for them, belief is what's in the party interest, right? So he believed that he was acting in the party interest, and that's the most important thing. But
I also think that maybe it's true that a lot of this stuff was allowed to happen because the people on the other side were also deeply unimpressive. There's so many people. Jim Jordan is actually one of the more impressive ones compared to the rest. He can actually debate and argue, and you get in front of him in a committee, and he actually knows his stuff.
They've done some very good stuff.
Doesn't wear a jacket.
Yeah, that's right, and he's not the best wrestling coach, but beyond that, but you know, you see these people in Trump world who are such buffoons, and they decide in some ways, particularly in the election stuff. I always took it that, like, we have created this environment now, this environment of distrust and nothing. And then they kind of latched onto this and said, you know, the election was stolen, this, and, the, you know, using the Russian misinformation nonsense, which it was ultimately nonsense. And let's be clear about this. It did exist. You know, there was the hacking, but that was not, by the way, that was not sophisticated hacking, just to be clear. This is stuff where, you know, it's phishing attacks where you like, you know, it's social engineering where people click on a link.
Very low grade.
Low grade.
We should name Michael Moynihan the Minister of Sophistication. He just like issues judgments of what is and what isn't.
Well, that is not sophisticated. Look, what you get when in, you know, unit, what, 8700, 8900, they do zero-day exploits. They find things that nobody knows about and they exploit them. Whereas the Russian stuff was literally like, click the link to this PDF, and there's some shithead.
I am the president of Google. I require your password.
Yes, and they're like, all right, let me just get that in there. Let me speed up this process. And the next thing you know, all these emails are stolen. But it's also for people who are unfamiliar with this stuff, is that this is what all intelligence agencies do, including our own, and including Canada, every single person. And also, like, look, it's left and right. So the left, you know, has accused the intelligence agencies of cooking the books on, you know, in a political way. I mean, remember, and if anyone doesn't know this, you probably don't, there's a thing called Team B. And that was, there was Team A that had a Soviet missile gap assessment. And so they created Team B, which was Richard Pipes from Harvard, a Cold War hawk, et cetera, a number of people. And they produced this Team B report that said, no, all that stuff is fake. And there was clearly an ideological dimension to it. And I think Team B had some stuff right, they had some stuff wrong. But these kind of ideological wars within intelligence agencies are not only not new, they're completely standard. It's completely boring to say that this is something, oh my God, they did this to Trump. It's like, well, that makes sense to me. I don't think it's good, but it makes sense to me.
It's the power. It's the, like, using levels of latitude that weren't used before. I think that's what makes
it. Yeah, and I think that the internet really does makes it qualitatively different because we have, and you know, COVID was big in this too. We've now herded hundreds of millions of people into surveillance traps. And within those surveillance traps, where they are being collected on continuously, and profiles are being created, and there is predictive analysis being performed to figure out what their inclinations are, people are simply more susceptible to certain kinds of social and psychological inducements. It doesn't mean that those inducements can perform exactly the task that you know, the taskmaster wants, but it means that we're now living inside of vast cybernetic enclosures that we have barely begun to understand. And within these vast cybernetic enclosures, we're witnessing new kinds of social phenomena, these digital swarms that are, they're unique. And I think, Michael, what you're describing is a cycle that we have entered in which the secrecy and conspiracy of the government induces a paranoia and counter-conspiracy among the kind of opposition, and these things feed off of each other, and it's very difficult to get out of that. But when you have the largest conspiracy in modern American history was carried out against the president of the United States. I mean, I view Russiagate is having no equivalent in contemporary history in the United States, and it's something much more, what you would expect in from the Egyptian security agencies, and that has very long-term and unpredictable consequences when you have seeded that into the kind of into the public square, into the psyche, you can't really control it. And it leads nowhere good. And this is not to justify all of the manias that have cropped up in response to it, but it is to say that they feed off of each other.
It could lead to somewhere good, in my libertarian opinion, if people reacted to either government malfeasance or internal government skullduggery like this, say maybe less power for those people. But that has not been on the table for 8 years.
That's never on the table. We don't
have, it was on the table in 1974. It's not never on the table.
Well, you
it's
have
absolutely on the table.
The Church Commission
in response to Richard Nixon Watergate, which is an interesting little like wrinkle that has not been at all anyone's point of view.
One of my favorite results of this, particularly of Russiagate, and he's a listener to the show, a very close listener, so he'll give me a hard time if I get any of this wrong, is our dear friend and frequent guest and my debate partner from the other day, Eli Lake, who has on his own podcast done a bunch of stuff that made people on his own neocon universe angry. Because he did a bunch of stuff on the Church Commission and the deep state stuff. And he's like doing a series now. Eli's about to start doing a big series on the deep state. If you've listened to his podcast, which are just monologues, it's not very far from where Jake is. And I said to Eli, like, oh, you've changed on this. And he said, yeah, well, I'm not going to mention any names. Certain people in his universe have sent him angry messages like, what the fuck are you doing? The Church Commission? You're like on the side of these guys? And he's like, yeah, you know, they're right about certain things. But we don't have Jake for very long because we're going to run up against time in a bit. But I do want to talk about Israel. Because
where he escaped,
right? Where Jake, who not only is a veteran of Afghanistan, and has written about that too, but he's also somebody. So he knows the military end of this. He's also moved to Israel. What, 3-4 years ago?
Little over three years ago.
So you're there on October 7th when this happens. I don't even know where to begin on this. I mean, what do you make of, I guess, the debate in your home country where you grew up and the city you're in right now, New York, where you grew up, when you see all this stuff and you see the kids protesting and, you know, people shouting about this and the general debate about it on Twitter and on all these places, what do you think people are, I'll start this way. What do you think people are mostly getting wrong about this from the vision of somebody who not only has a military background, but actually lives in Israel?
Well, what are people getting wrong about the war? They're thinking that there is a viable path to destroy Hamas, which is a discrete military entity operating inside of Gaza, and that Israel is choosing not to do that because it prefers to brutalize innocent Palestinians. And so that's wrong in seven different ways. Mm-hmm. For one thing, Hamas is not a discrete military entity, right? Hamas is enmeshed within a larger regional security framework headed by Iran that also includes the Houthis, that also includes Hezbollah, that also includes Shia militias in Iraq and Syria, like Kitab Hezbollah, all of which have attacked Israel continuously throughout this war. Moreover, the form of war that Israel is pursuing in Gaza, which is a absolutely brutal form of war, is also which is conventional urban combat.
Very conventional.
Is also the only form of war that has produced a U.S.-led victory in the last three decades.
In Mosul.
Yeah. So the alternative that the people think there's an alternative, which is counterinsurgency or counterterrorism, is, for one thing, ensures a decade-long military occupation of Gaza. I mean, that's what counterinsurgency and effective counterterrorism entail. There's something, you know, at the start of the war, there were 35,000 Hamas members, let's say, deeply embedded in Gazan society who could make use of a, you know, 300 to 500 mile fortified tunnel network, rocket and small arms caches deposited throughout Gaza. And so the idea that there's like a quick, clean form of counterinsurgency that was the alternative to this is just utterly deluded. And it's not only deluded in the sense that it wouldn't be clean, it would require a long-term occupation where the Israelis would be ruling over Gazan citizens.
And likely far more deaths.
Certainly, potentially far more deaths. It's also suggesting that what the Israelis should have done was imitate precisely the strategy that led to the strategically catastrophic U.S. defeats mm-hmm. in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've spent a long time writing about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, both of which I served in as a U.S. Army officer, and I have been very critical of counterinsurgency.
Yeah.
And many of the people who were highly receptive to my critiques of counterinsurgency warfare, which I see is, in the American version, as an inherently imperial kind of warfare that we need to get away from, many of the people who are very highly receptive to those critiques totally ignore all of this when it comes to Israel because they're ideologically hostile to Israel. And so they simply ignore this and they suggest that what's motivating the Israelis is wanton brutality.
I mean, you essentially see this, by the way, when you have somebody like, I mean, just I could pick a bunch of people. The easiest one would be like somebody like Tucker Carlson. And Tucker, I think that if he listened to everything you said for the previous 60 minutes, would be nodding his head so vigorously that it'd pass out. That when it came to this, and you've seen this, and I think there's a kind of a paleo Buchananite kind of thing that is very specific to Israel, that when this comes up, they tend to become Norman Finkelsteins. They tend to become people who believe that, you know, I don't know if Israel shouldn't even exist. I mean, all this while the conversation started in 1947, 1948. It's like, well, they stole, it's like, okay, let's forget about that. This is something that's going to exist as a country. How do we deal with it now? I mean, what do you make of all of that kind of, you know, rhetoric from people like that, who I'm sure sometimes you agree with?
Yeah, I think this brings us right back to Russiagate, because the other part of what people get wrong about Israel that's even harder to get across is that they have been, their entire analytical framework is wrong.
Because, who's they? Sorry.
Let's take Tucker Carlson as an example. His entire analytical framework is wrong. What do I mean by that? The idea that the U.S. is the stalwart ally of Israel that offers this unconditional support for Israel
is totally bullshit.
Is hysterically delusional.
100%.
No, but like make the case for those listeners who disagree.
I have said this before, and I want Jake probably knows a lot more about this than I do, but I would just say this, and I said this before, that there is not a war, and let's say we can start 1948, and you know where Truman was not willing to provide munitions to the Israelis in 1956, which Eisenhower said, "Nope, you're on your own. We're not going to have anything to do with that."
On the wrong side.
And then you know this is also true in 1967. This is also true in 1973. This is also true when Reagan pulls out of Lebanon in 1982, 1983.
And kind of true tonight.
Tonight
we're recording this on Wednesday, and Wednesday the Biden was on an interview with Aaron Burnett, I believe, on CNN.
Yeah.
And said that he is going to hold up munitions to Israel if they plan to go through with a Rafah.
Every single American president, I mean, people tend to think of Obama because Obama was quite loud about it, has tried to influence the Israelis in a way that they were not willing to be influenced. I mean, the idea of the Mersheimer, that they're just the puppeteers, is just belied by literally every piece of evidence. I find it very, very strange.
Well, there I have to disagree with you a bit. I mean, my problem with the Israelis is that they have allowed themselves to be far too influenced, including Benjamin Netanyahu, who accepted the aid from Obama, who he knew was hostile to Israel's interests and actively hostile.
I mean, remember when Netanyahu came and addressed Congress, that almost created the biggest rift in the history of American Israel.
Or remember when Obama was spying on members of Congress, right?
There's that a little bit.
Which was like really a foreshadowing of what was to come in Russiagate. Yeah. Look, the information environment that Obama created around this, all of which had to do with the Iran deal, which was broadly unpopular with the American public, and so required, you know, the best description of this is in the great New York Times Magazine profile of Benjamin Rhodes by David Samuels, in which Rhodes talks about how 27-year-old idiot reporters can be fed any information from the White House and they'll retail it to the public, and how this creates an echo chamber effect. We've been living inside that echo chamber.
We've seen that a lot
ever
now.
Since.
A lot now, yeah.
That is American politics. Now, when I talk about disinformation as a new form of government, this is what I'm talking about. The Iran deal was historically unpopular. Why was it historically unpopular? Because the Iranian regime, the Khomeinist regime, declared death to America, continuously attacked American soldiers, killed Americans, took them hostage, and this made the Iranian regime unpopular with Americans. But in the great brilliance of the Obama counter blob, which was really just a continuation of the foreign policy blob, like the geniuses, the mandarins of the Obama administration decided, no, the way we are going to solve the Middle East is by empowering Iran. The vehicle to do that was the JCPOA, the what was supposed to be the deal to prevent Iran from getting nukes, which was actually a way of providing an umbrella of protection for Iran to get nukes. And in order to make all of this work, right, you had to punish both Israel and Saudi Arabia, who were seen as the obstacles to this new Middle Eastern condominium that Obama was creating, in which by elevating the so-called moderates in Iran, the region would hold itself in check, because the new empowered moderate Iranian regime, you know, the guys who were screaming death to America yesterday, but they were like, they didn't really mean it when they said it, and they were only opportunistically saying death to America and you know, kill all the Jews. These people would now enter into a concert of powers with the other Middle Eastern powers, Turkey, Egypt, Israel, Saudi Arabia. This was highly unpopular, and so in order to get it through, the White House created this entirely new communications infrastructure. This is what Rhodes is talking about in the profile when he says he created an echo chamber. What the echo chamber was doing was drawing on these astroturfed nonprofit groups who were either created for the special purpose of retailing these messages or had institutional credibility from the past, but were hollowed out and co-opted by the party. And now their credibility was whored out to retailing these messages. And then, you know, the nonprofit talks to the 27-year-old idiot Daily Beast reporter, and they get
redundant.
And they get the coverage. There were a few exceptions.
Not me, not Harry.
We had some good colleagues. And now you create this entirely new information system, right? So I think somebody, and Tucker's hardly alone in this, but part of the way Obama did all of this was by casting any opposition to the Iran deal as ravenous Likud neocon warmongering. Yeah. So anybody who opposed this, right, was trying to suck the U.S. back into a war in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Now, the ultimate instrument of making all of this work vis-a-vis Israel was the largest aid package in history, right? It was massive aid package that Obama and Bibi signed. And so to me, it was a very significant responsibility within the Israeli ruling establishment, starting with Netanyahu, for agreeing to this. The aid package, I mean, in every other circumstance, we understand that when the United States spends vast sums of money, we call that soft power, right? Like these people who are realpolitik critics in every other circumstance and who are like, you know, really go out on a limb to try and understand Russia's motivations for responding to the, you know, NATO aggression by invading Ukraine. Like these same people look at the Israeli-U.S. relationship and conclude that Israel is the master that is puppeteering the U.S. It's absurd. The actual position between the U.S. and Israel right now is that Israel is a client state of the U.S., in a Middle East that is full of U.S. client states, and the actual U.S. policy is to prevent Israel from destroying Hamas, because destroying Hamas would upset the balance of power among its client states. There's a reason why one of the first order of business, one of the White House's first orders of business was to tell Israel, you can't strike Hezbollah, when they were initially planning to strike Hezbollah. There's also a reason why.
Or with Iran, too. I mean, keeping in mind that that barrage from Iran, which we tend to not pay attention to, or people didn't, because so few of those drones and, you know, other rockets, too, got through. But that was one of the largest, you know, attacks on Israel, I think, ever. I mean, that must have been.
I think it was one of the largest attacks ever.
Attacks, not period, just
on
Israel. Ever.
And the only direct one from
Iran. The only direct one from Iran since 1979. Yeah, but you have that. And the response to that was, hey, guys, let's try not to overreact to this and not do very much. And what you said, the Aaron Burnett thing, which is, to Jake's point, and I think that a lot of people listening to this will say, oh, that makes a certain amount of sense, because when you have a war that is being fought in the way that this is being fought, which has been to these 12-year-olds that are, you know, occupying Washington Square Park, who have never seen a war before, and now they're seeing it on TikTok. They don't know how this stuff works. They say this is the most brutal war of all time. Even if we trust the numbers that are coming out of the Gaza Health Ministry, which we shouldn't trust, but if we did trust those, it wouldn't even come close to being the most brutal war of the past 5 years. It's absolutely ridiculous to say so. But what if you don't go into Rafah, what happens is obviously that Hamas, you know, retreats all the way south, and where are those hostages? The ones that we hope that are still alive, and the bodies of the ones that they've murdered. The rest, Sinwar, the rest of those people, they're in the tunnel network beneath Rafah. And so what does the Biden administration say? Well, we're not going to give you all those things that you need to conduct that operation because you shouldn't finish this war. What kind of war would this be if the number of Israeli soldiers who have died, the number of innocent civilians who have died on October 7th, said, you know, we'll just stop right now.
33 Americans too.
So, okay, that's actually funny because somebody sent us an email today about this. I responded to him. And he said, why is no one talking about the Americans that were killed on October 7th? And I responded to him and I said, well, thank you for pointing this out. I've been thinking about this and talking about it too, is that why don't they talk about the number of American hostages there are too? But the difference is that in Israel, it's not considered to be American if you have dual citizenship. If you are a Jew who's decided that you're going to make Aliyah and go to Israel, no one cares. No, like, I mean, 1979, we talk about those Americans that were held hostage. It upended an election, for Christ's sake. You have these Americans that are sitting in some sort of tunnel, hopefully they're still alive, under Rafah, and no one cares. Why? Well, I suppose because, do I want to be so cheap as to say, I suppose because they're Jews? No, I think it's because they're dual citizens and they don't consider that being really American. But what can we say to an administration that says, you have fought this war, do not finish it. Do not go into Rafah. It is the wildest thing to me, considering this is a government and a military in Israel that has provided, you know, here is the exit. Here are the tent cities that we've set up. Wars are ugly. Wars are not pretty. I'm sorry that people have to live in tents. But if you don't want to wage a war, don't start a war. I don't know why that's so controversial to say these days. But incredible to me that the administration would say that. And to Jake's point, which kind of sharpens that, why that would be. Why would they say, do not finish? It's not Michigan. That's bullshit.
Total nonsense.
Total Michigan. Nonsense.
Well, let's fucking steel man this. Why you do it is that it's American weapons fighting
It's been American weapons all along.
It's American weapons in Yemen too, but let's put that aside for a second. But like Americans, and I'd like you to talk about this because I think it's underappreciated. Like my feeling is that Americans, and this is an ignorant feeling, America wants there not to be too much war. Like it's a, sort of like it's a, can we do like a light smother on the war-ishness? And there isn't a lot of strategery beyond that. And so there is a sense of, look, it's our weaponry here. It's definitely the weaponry too in the civil war in Yemen with Saudi Arabia. They've purchased $140 billion worth of American armaments over the past several decades. Israel's the biggest recipient of American aid. You wrote a piece that I cribbed entirely for a reason, forthcoming reason piece. And I'm curious to hear your updates on this, frankly. It's in tablet in July of last year. It provoked a lot of response that I found less actually convincing than your piece, regardless of how much I agree with it. You and Leah Leibowitz saying basically end aid to Israel. And it was done from a pro-Israeli point of view, which is not the usual Bernie Sanders, Mike Lee, Rand Paul point of view. I'm curious how you look at the recent developments, you know, starting with literally tonight with Biden saying no more munitions for Rafah, we'll cut you off. But like how your argument and tablet in July of last year looks different in the wake of October 7th and the different...
I think it looks different because it's been thoroughly vindicated. And so,
boy.
There was a lot of pushback last year, including from Israeli security officials.
Yeah.
And I think people have, they see now what the cost of sacrificing your sovereignty is. I wrote that piece from both a pro-Israel and a pro-American position because I think aid is often... a bad instrument of policy, and particularly I think that aid in the Middle East, I think that the U.S. involvement in the Middle East has been chaotic and destructive, with the exception of the Trump years, and I'll come back to that in a minute. I think that Trump was a very good foreign policy president in the Middle East, precisely because rather than trying to manage client states in a overextended portfolio where you're constantly increasing volatility and existential risk by supporting both sides of every conflict, Trump had a much more archaic
deal-making,
but also I maximally back allies and I maximally punish adversaries. And unfortunately, that has not become a sort of broader foreign policy framework. You know, when I talk to people who tell me I recognize what the Biden administration is doing in Israel is insane, but I can't bring myself to vote for Trump. I say, okay, that's fine. You know, I don't vote at all. But what you ought to do then is recognize what worked. Don't be so jealously partisan that you can't steal something from Trump. Trump's foreign policy was highly effective. And there's this whole sort of revisionist attempt now by Biden supporters, liberal Biden supporters, to pretend that this wasn't the case. But in fact, it was, look, if what you actually care about is peace and Palestinian lives, there was a lot more peace and there were a lot fewer Palestinians being killed during the Trump years than there have been during the Biden years. It's also, by the way, there was more peace during the Trump years than there was during the Obama years as well, for exactly the same reason. Because
do you think that October 7th, had Trump won a second term, wouldn't have happened?
Absolutely. Well, that's too strong. I don't think it would have happened. I think that the reasons it happened have everything to do with the policies that the Biden administration pursued from the
really? Day. Really? October 7th is a Biden thing.
No, I don't think that that would be too strong. Look, the U.S. role in the region is to set conditions, right? Then the regional actors exploit those conditions. But
so
what,
it's like
what were the
boundaries, right? Like it's the bumpers.
What? Yeah, exactly. What is permissible and what is incentivized? So taking the Houthis off the terrorism list, freeing up billions of dollars to Iran, recentering the Palestinian question vis-a-vis the Israelis, backing the anti-Bibi protests, forcing Israel into this absurd maritime agreement with Lebanon, which meaning Hezbollah, putting $1 billion into an embassy in Lebanon, meaning subsidizing Hezbollah, all of these actions together telegraphed a window of opportunity in which, and by the way, and also, you know, immediately trying to anathematize Saudi Arabia, declaring, you know, a sort of moral calumnies against Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudis, only to then have to go back sort of, you know, hat in hand and say, hey, can you turn the oil back
on? He didn't put his hand on the globe.
Fair enough. But yeah, all of this makes the United States look week.
And you see something like tonight when Joe Biden is stuttering his way through an interview with Aaron Burnett and saying, we are not going to provide weapons for you to deliver the knockout blow to Hamas. I think it's probably fairly obvious to say that Trump would never do something like that. Whether what he would do would be the smart thing, the right thing.
It wouldn't be on Aaron Burnett.
I don't think it would be on Aaron Burnett. But I wonder if that would happen because what Trump never likes to do is to telegraph weakness in any way.
Or including with his allies. Yeah. He doesn't want losers for friends. So he doesn't want to make his... Now, he might like smack them down, occasionally. But the archaic sort of... macho or classicist, as you prefer, Trump foreign policy produced more peace in the world. I can't stress this enough. Like, whatever you think about the underlying ideological motivations, whatever you think about how these two different approaches comport with your own sense of justice, if we are looking at outcomes, right, there were two Israel-Hamas wars under President Obama. There have now been two, including the deadliest war, so far under Biden. There were zero under Trump. It's not mere coincidence. Trump established a different security order in the Middle East. That security order produced more peace in the region.
So would you give that credit to Jared Kushner?
I'd certainly give some of it to Jared Kushner.
Does that feel good?
I've long since stopped caring about any of this stuff. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like Kushner or whoever, I give the credit to whoever did the thing that produced the outcome. I don't think, it wasn't just about Israel and the Palestinians or Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Like there was a broader, there was the maximum pressure campaign against Iran. There was killing Soleimani, which was one of the single most effective uses of U.S. military power in decades, right? Do you remember?
I remember the predictions.
That's what I'm talking about. Just like the predictions for recognizing Jerusalem.
The predictions about Israel like clapping back against Iran.
Right, right.
So is it? Would it be fair to say that taking Trump out of the scenario entirely as a person, as a president, that had there been a president in those same years, that regardless of what Trump did in domestic policy, that was maybe more neoconservative? Because these are sort of neoconservative positions in a way. Do you think, vis-a-vis Israel, I'm not talking about anywhere else, would the same result have happened if there was a kind of John Bolton presidency, somebody who was very hawkish on Iran, very supportive of the Likud government,
and was in the Trump administration.
It was in the Trump administration, of course. And somebody willing to take shots at people like Soleimani or crush Iranian groups operating in Iraq. Is it Trump, or would that have happened if there was kind of a neocon version of it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it was neoconservative. And, Bolton later complained about Trump and complained about being restrained.
And Bolton also does not self-identify as a neoconservative.
He does not. No, yes. He does not.
We can talk about it.
I think he's closer. He's close enough. But no, if we understand neoconservatism in the sort of baseline level of neoconservative policy in the Middle East also has to include a democratizing agenda, right? This is essential to the neoconservative understanding of what produces peace. Trump was...
Although I think they abandoned that at about 2006.
Some of them did. You'd be surprised. Yeah. I think
Elliot Abrams is still in the game.
Yeah.
And they are also overconfident about what U.S. military power can accomplish, right? Trump was a Jacksonian, and what that entailed was overwhelming power in short durations and on behalf of or in service of very clearly defined American interests. I mean, I think this is precisely not the neoconservative foreign policy vision, and we were much better for it. We were much better for this kind of narrowly defined...
So let me frame it in a slightly different way. Is that what if it were a Buchananite kind of like, let's get America out of the business of everything, or this is a sort of libertarian kind of worldview? I mean, You're talking about the Soleimani thing is the exact opposite of that. It's actually throwing American power around and killing somebody in
killing an enemy.
An enemy, of course. But that is not something that, you know, the Lou Rockwells or the Pat Buchanans of the world want to do at all. So saying not that either.
So what would be the word? The person who I look to in these matters is Angelo Codevilla, who called himself a libertarian.
He's a BU professor, right? Yeah.
He was a BU professor. He was at Claremont. Yeah. He was wrote some pieces for Tablet toward the end of his life. He also worked for Moynihan.
Yes, he did.
And on the church committee.
The good one.
And was...
The smart one.
The respectable one.
And, not the piece of shit one.
Yeah. And was a naval intelligence officer. And Codevilla was a libertarian who articulated a theory of American power that sort of... accounted for the lack of that theory and standard libertarian ideology. So he saw libertarians as not only incapable of defending America's interests because they had adopted too much of a sort of retreat from any kind of power projection. He also saw libertarians as having abandoned the, let's say, John Quincy Adams vision of American power and the Monroe Doctrine and these sort of classical articulations of where America's interests lie in the world. Yeah. And what Codevilla focused on was, how do we define our own peace, right? So how do we define the peace that this war is intended to achieve? And what is the application of American military power that will protect our core interests that achieves that peace? So for Codevilla, simply retreating from the Middle East would not be a viable solution because protecting waterways, for instance, is a core American interest. And this is something like the paleocons have never been able to figure this out. And the paleocons sort of succumb to their own moralizing temptation with a lot of this stuff. They I think have some good instincts in certain places, but they end up not being able to provide a genuine account of how they would defend America's interests. Codevilla did provide that account, and it looked a lot like Trumpism in the Middle East. Leave aside all the domestic stuff, and you could even leave aside Trump's policy in certain other parts of the world. But in the Middle East in particular, you know, Trump was trying to get out of Afghanistan, which was the right thing to do because there was no longer any connection.
Let's not give him credit for trying. Like, Biden did it shittily, but he did it.
And I gave Biden credit.
Yeah.
And when that happened, I wrote publicly.
This is just a lot of people, it's not you, but there's a lot of people, especially like libertarian leaning, like quasi MAGA enthusiasts, who are like, oh, Trump is way more with us on foreign policy. Like, he totally wanted to get out of Afghanistan. It's like, are you going to sell like free Julian Assange shirts with Trump's hair on it?
Okay.
Or are you going to actually point out who got out of Afghanistan?
There's a problem with this though, right? You're on much firmer ground with Assange, where I think like he should have freed Assange, and it's wrong that he didn't. And my views have evolved on Assange.
Mine have changed dramatically.
Yeah. So I remember we talked about this years ago.
Yeah. I think we were similar. It's funny to see how many people's views have evolved in, you know, a sort of neoconservative.
Still not a good dancer.
Friend of mine, friend of yours too, is Jamie Kirchick wrote a piece with the New York Times saying, maybe I was wrong about this
that's
stuff,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
And I think that I've kind of come to the same, I don't like him personally. And then you have to pull that away and say, oh, maybe.
He shouldn't be in jail,
insane. But
But look, briefly, let's recall what happened to Trump's withdrawal plan from Afghanistan. It was sabotaged by a deliberate information operation to plant the Russian bounties story.
I get it. But he's in charge.
I agree. Fundamentally,
literally,
that's true.
Literally is the chief and the commander.
You're right.
It's like him.
But it testifies to the point about politics in America being conducted through information operations. Trump was on course to affecting this peace plan and withdrawing American troops from Afghanistan, and this utterly false, totally cooked intelligence agency story about Russia placing bounties on American soldiers in Afghanistan was fed through anonymous sources to the national security reporters at the Washington Post and the New York Times, and was then fed from them into Congress. And then generated, you know, this is the classic sort of
never been a journalism scandal. That thing.
It's one of the great scandals.
Should be a fucking journalist.
Absolutely. It's one of the great scandals.
One of the journalism scandals that I've mentioned before that should be and wasn't, that anytime you happen upon on YouTube an old episode of the Rachel Maddow Show, you realize how deep it went and how, you know, I mean, watch a full episode of that from, say, 2018, 2019. No, do. It's your homework. You're fired if you don't. I'm firing you from the podcast.
You can't.
I'm deputizing myself to fire you unless you watch that hideous show from 2019. But yeah, like the journalism scandal. It was, what's his name? The guy who wrote the thing for CJR? Former New York Times.
I know what you're talking about.
There was like a three-part.
Rise and Rosen.
No, it wasn't Rise.
No, it was very good.
Very good. And he was a former New York Times national security guy. Yeah, what the hell was his name?
Jeff Gerth,
exactly. Yeah. Thing was like an accounting of this stuff. And I read it, obviously, because it's very good. But go back and read the responses to it. The responses were incredible. People lost their minds. And did they lose their minds in saying, well, he was substantially wrong about this, that, and the other? No, it was just like, you know, oh, he's gotten on the MAGA train. This is Jeff Gerth becoming a Trump mouthpiece or something. But all right, we're up against a lot of time here, and I have my daughter here. Well, she's very upset because the Panthers are up 4-1 now. This is a bad game for the Bruins.
What about the Knicks?
I haven't looked. I don't watch that kind of thing. So Jake has a flight back to Israel tonight, and a secret plane,
private
flight that is Sheldon Adelson's cousin who is flying him.
No, it's a guy named. They just gave me the initial P. Diddy. They said for some reason the plane was available at the last minute. Said I could use it.
Final question, Jake.
Yes.
If Jeffrey Epstein said, come to my island, everything is paid for, I'm going to fly, you'd go, right?
I mean, what's the catering situation?
That's what I'm asking. Right. So I want listeners to know that Jake might be on my side in this one, that people like hanging out with guys who have their own islands, and it's very easy to convince me. So
depends on the spread.
Exactly. And the spread is very good. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we will be back again, I guess, this weekend we'll do something this weekend.
Second Sunday's coming.
Second Sunday.
Mother's Day.
Mother's Day. Oh. Your hideous wife, your horrible wife, leave her with the kids, because Mother's Day should
husband.
Be. Should,
come,
no,
come.
No, no, no. They should be celebrating their time with their children on Mother's Day.
No, come you with us. Come.
We have some women listeners, don't we?
Yeah,
I guess we do.
Send pictures for
me. Well, you guys have been very good about this recently, and I'm very, very happy about it. So keep it coming. Keep sending me photographs. And in about a month, we'll have a contest. We'll have a special episode where I go through them, and we talk through them, and you can come and join us on the podcast.
Nope.
Yeah, well, Camille's not going to be here.
I mean, it's a podcast. So.
Because he probably has a conference with who? Give me a name.
The Multifarious Institute, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that is that
technology.
Is, I think Mark Andreessen's probably involved in this.
Jake Siegel.
Of the Siegels, and as I told you the other day, we did mention the passing of your father, who I had an enormous amount of respect for, and I've gone back and read a bunch of his stuff. One of the finest intellectuals of the latter part of the 20th century, who was one of those old socialist guys who decided that maybe he wasn't an old socialist at the end. And your brother, Harry Siegel, who we have to get back on, because he would be across this table, pulling his hair out, screaming at his brother. Because he's a bit soft.
Like I want to hear Jake Siegel's Jesse Jackson impersonation.
What does he think? He has one?
Jaime Town. I don't know. That's all I know.
Yeah. I win.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. I'm saying the Siegels. Out there in Brooklyn.
That's good.
They are Jews, and they are hammies, and they are causing a problem for America. My grape turned to a raisin. Now that, by the way, I've mentioned this many times, my favorite speech of all time is Jesse Jackson's Hymietown apology at the 1984 Democratic Convention, in which he says that his grape may have turned to a raisin.
Happens to me every
time. And his joy bell may have lost its resonance, but charge it to my head, not to my heart, because he didn't mean it. Bye.
We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse, the fifth column.